From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. On today's JX, an interview we could not pass up, a combination of the very old and the very young. The very old is a story written in ancient Egypt about various occupations. Basically, it's a guide to how horrible all jobs are, except for scribes. The very young in this story is the person who translated the ancient tale, Michael Hoffman, a junior in high school. You'll hear about his project. Down the hour, we go a little further back in time to the beginning of everything. Big Bang followed by physics, chemistry, and evolution, right? Or the hand of God building and shaping. You'll hear from a psychiatrist who believes in a mixture of both. You'll hear from Samuel T. Wilkinson, who wrote the book Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. That's ahead on the Jefferson Exchange. First, the news of the hour. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR for Monday, May 6th, 2024. We broadcast to Southern Oregon and Northern California, and you can hear us streaming online at jeffexchange.org. I'm Jeffrey Riley. On today's JX, why being a scribe is the best job and how God and evolution can coexist. You'll hear from the high school junior who can read ancient Egyptian and who translated an ancient job pamphlet. Later on, you'll hear from the psychiatrist who embraces both evolution and religion and how he finds brain space for both. Stand by for those interviews after our weather forecast. This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Life in ancient Egypt is the subject of many books, and movies too, for that matter. But those tend to be the work of modern writers. We hear from someone who actually lived in ancient Egypt in a new book for younger readers, Be a Scribe, Working for a Better Life in Ancient Egypt. Three authors get credit for the book, Michael Hoffman, Dr. Christian Casey, and Dr. Jen Thumb. We're going to talk to Michael Hoffman, who was all of 17 years old. He did the translation work for the book from a text written way back then by a fourth author we'll hear about. Michael Hoffman, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've been translating ancient texts for a while now. How young were you when you did the first one?
Well, I'd say I was around, I think it was in the summer of 2021, so I must have been around 14 or 15. When I first began translating this text, which is called A Satire on the Trades.
Satire of the Trades. So we'll talk a little more about the book, but I still want to hear more about you and how you first got into translating ancient Egyptian. How did you get started on that path?
Of course. So it was during the pandemic, and I had a lot of time on my hands. I was 13 years old, and I realized that, you know, I wanted to pick up a new skill, and I ended up learning hieroglyphs. I'd been interested in history my whole life, and sort of, it seemed like almost a natural thing to do. I began learning hieroglyphs actually from my co-authors in the book, Christian Casey. He's at a university in Germany right now. And, he has a PhD, he's a postdoctorate. And I began learning hieroglyphs. And after about a year, this is the summer of 2021, I realized that, you know, many of the museums were still closed. Many of the schools were still closed. My school is like hybrid. And I realized that, you know, the only real way that younger audiences could learn about ancient Egypt and ancient history was through a book. And many of the books out there, they were filled with these artificial illustrations or modern-day recreations of ancient Egyptian things. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's quite special to learn history if you're looking at, you know, a real piece of ancient Egyptian jewelry or a real ancient Egyptian tomb scene. And that's where the idea for the book was conceived. And I realized early on, along with Jen and Christian, that that it would be helpful to base the book around like an ancient Egyptian text, because that also introduced the kids to like a real primary source from ancient Egypt. Like, I feel like in schools you might learn something from ancient Greece or ancient Rome, but like you rarely ever hear a text learning literature from ancient Egypt. And I thought it was quite a unique opportunity to present that. And that's just sort of how the idea for the book came about.
I really appreciate having a primary source myself. I can't say I've ever read something that was a direct translation from ancient Egypt, and there it is, the whole thing. So where did we find this Satire of the Trades? And it's written by a young man named Hedy, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. It was written about 1,500 BCE, so like 3,500 years ago. And it's the main copy is in the British Museum in London. But there's also a number of like little ostraca, like little pieces of pottery that like a scribal student would copy down and write on, that little fragments of the text survive that way too. And it was written essentially, Chedi is like the main character. He's the author, but he's also the main character in the story, along with his son. They're the only two characters, really. And they're traveling down the Nile, where Chedi wants to enroll his son in scribal school. And Chedi essentially lists out a bunch of different jobs that he has, that he could have, that his son could have, if he doesn't get to become a scribe. And because Chedi is a minor and his son's a scribe, and so he wants his son to be a scribe, so he essentially exaggerates a lot, and he says, you know, all these other jobs are extremely bad, you should not want them, but you should want the job of the scribe, and here's why the job of the scribe is the best job of all. And that's essentially the basis of the story.
It is pretty funny because, yeah, every job it seems like, you know, that the barber got tired arms, you know, this guy had a hard job, this guy, the sandal maker had to chew on leather all day. I mean, he makes all the jobs other than scribe sound really awful.
I know. They're all very, he makes them all sound really bad. In fact, probably worse than they actually are.
So, all right. So Chedi was a real person. It wasn't just a made up thing.
No, he was a real person, but likely he wasn't a minor, because if he was a minor, then he probably wouldn't be writing a story, because he wouldn't know how to read and write.
Oh, he would have been a scribe himself.
Yeah, so it's a bit it's a bit funny that way, you know. It's a classic work of fiction. He's pretending to be something that he's not.
We're talking to Michael Hoffman here on the Jefferson Exchange, who did the translation work of an ancient text for a book that is now out as Be a Scribe, Working for a Better Life in Ancient Egypt for Younger Readers. So was it a complete text then? I mean, the whole story is there in the British Museum?
So there are some parts of it that are missing, because the main papyrus that it's on is called Papyrus Salier. Named after a French collector of Egyptian ancient Egyptian goods, and there are some fragments that are missing. And when I was doing the translation, Christian and I, we often had to use the other ostraca, like I was talking about, in order to fill in those gaps, because sometimes there are little fragments that are missing, and we couldn't, and it would be impossible to figure it out otherwise.
It's really interesting as we get into the book and get into the details, because this is, along with the ancient text, is some explanation of how the language worked. And so there are sounds. It's not like Chinese writing of today, which is symbols suggesting things and not direct sounds. These were sounds, I understand, but no vowels in the ancient Egyptian language.
No, actually, there were no vowels. And this is actually something that can be quite confusing if you start learning ancient Egyptian, because many of the letters we pronounce as if they're vowels, but in reality they weren't vowels, like if an ancient Egyptian said them. And so that's one of the main problems in trying to figure out what the language sounds like. Even to this day, we still don't know what the language sounds like exactly, because once it died out, you know, people, we couldn't resuscitate it, and we've no idea. We're just sort of making guesses now as to what it sounds like. And now there have been recently some attempts to try to reconstruct it from a descendant of the language called Coptic, which is spoken by still spoken by Egyptian Copts, but it's we still don't know exactly what the language sounded like.
So how long was the process for you? It sounds like Christian and Jen helped you quite a bit, but how long a process to completely decode all of the text from Chedi?
It was I started the translation. The translation itself took about maybe three months during the summer. But the whole book itself took about maybe almost 2 years.
Wow. Was there a lot of guessing? It's, like you mentioned, without the vowels there, you're kind of guessing at what certain words were?
Well, some of the words, obviously, there have been previous translations in the past. We set out to make our own. And there's this one section that many of the previous translations actually disagreed about, and this is the what we have as leather worker. But the previous translations had things like the furnace tender or the fire stoker or things like that, because there wasn't really people did the title for the section. No one really knows what that word means, and so we just have to kind of guess what that word means based on the evidence, based on the description from that section of what the guy seems to be doing. And so it's almost it's it, in some points, it's a little bit of guesswork and just sort of making, looking at what seems right and what would make the most sense based on the context.
Well, and not just that, even when you knew the words, it seems like you were running up against ancient Egyptian idioms, which don't necessarily make sense to people outside the culture.
Sometimes ancient Egyptian idioms can be quite a little bit hard to understand. Like, for example, there's one that's, it's like a boat upon the water, and that would be, essentially a translation of that into more understandable language. Would be like, it's like a safe decision, or it's a good decision. Like, you know, a boat upon the water is a place where you can, it's like, if you're drowning, it's like something that you can hold on to for support and sustenance. So it's like, it can make sense once you think about it, but these are idioms that like aren't necessarily familiar to you at first glance. Mm-hmm. And it was actually really interesting to see idioms like that and different literary devices.
Michael Hoffman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, 17 years old, and the translator for a book called Be a Scribe, Working for a Better Life in Ancient Egypt, taken from the ancient text known as the Satire of the Trades, with some help from Dr. Christian Casey and Dr. Jen Thumb. So we mentioned that all the other jobs other than scribe sound terrible. We mentioned about the barber getting tired arms. Talk about the culture of shaving back then. This is really interesting sidelight.
Yeah, sure. So essentially, you know, today we imagine our barbershop sort of like it's a barbershop, right? It's in one place and everybody goes to the barbershop. But back then, based on the evidence from the story, barbers were actually traveling barbers and they'd go from town to town and from street to street, as Khadi described, shaving different people. And you can see in the tomb scene that we present in the book that he's essentially on the street and there's a bunch of people lined up waiting to get shaved. And shaving was particularly important, was an important thing for ancient Egyptians, particularly for priests, because priests had to be completely shaved all over their bodies in order to be considered pure. But even for ordinary ancient Egyptians, children always had one particular and distinct haircut with like a side lock on the side of their head. It was quite different from our own, that there was less from our own culture in that there was less, more people follow the same kind of hairstyle and haircut and shaving, you know. So it was a very important job, but also it was, you know, there was less room for like you wouldn't see people getting dyed hair or crazy haircuts back then, you know.
The descriptions like that are very vivid, and I wonder, because of the way that this is, it is pretty much like a pamphlet convincing somebody that the career they want is as a scribe. What do you think it was written for younger readers then?
Well, actually, this text was used, so when young students were learning to be a scribe, like Pepe was in the story, when young students were learning to be a scribe, they often had to transcribe stories, like, for example, this one, and also other texts that they had to transcribe in order to show their skill and mastery of the language. There are many ostraca that show a student transcribing this text onto a piece of pottery, and then a teacher sort of makes corrections with a red with red ink.
Mm-hmm.
That just surprised me because it reminded me of like, you know, when I get a test back, if I make mistakes, many of the mistakes are crossed out in red ink. So, I mean, yes, there's definite evidence that this text was used as like an instruction tool for younger students who are learning the language.
Now, later in the book, there are some details on the proper comportment for scribes. I mean, do we know how common that position was and how scribes were viewed by the rest of society?
Well, scribes were essentially the elite of society because at that time, most people didn't know how to read or write. And so therefore, if you had that skill, you automatically were given certain positions that guaranteed you a better life. And like even the lowliest of scribes could work as tax collectors or people who transcribe things that the pharaoh said and so on. But if you're a scribe, you can often rise into the highest positions in society and become a vizier who is overseeing the entire economy and government of Egypt.
Wow. So, yeah, definitely some important people.
Second in line to the pharaoh.
Oh, wow. That is close. Yes. So it is, like I said, a very vivid book, a great glimpse into the lives of people 3,500 years ago. What do you hope that people take away from reading this book?
I hope that people take away two things from the book. I hope they, number one, take away a better understanding of what it was like to live in ancient Egypt, but I also hope they take away a better understanding of what it was like to think as an ancient Egyptian. Because I think the two aspects of the book are sort of, number one, you have the depiction of all the jobs, and you have the depiction of the tomb scenes and the objects and different things like that. And that'll hopefully give my readers a better understanding of, like, you know, imagine you take a time machine back to ancient Egypt and wake up one day, what might you see, you know? And obviously you can't be certain about what you'll see, but hopefully this book will give you a general understanding of what it must be like to actually take a time machine back and go to ancient Egypt. And then secondly, what I like to think as an ancient Egyptian, I think just reading that story, the satire on the trades, really helped you understand Khedi's perspective. I mean, you read about how Khedi wanted his son to enroll in scribal school and pushes his son to adopt all this wisdom and study hard in school. It really gets you to understand, like, what's going through the mind of an ancient Egyptian and what it must have been like, you know, because what it must have been like to think as an ancient Egyptian. It's like sort of jump into their shoes.
And we really do get a feel for that. It's quite a refreshing read. It's called Be a Scribe, Working for a Better Life in Ancient Egypt, a translation with some help of the Satire of the Trades from 3,500 years ago. Michael Hoffman, 17 years old, did most of the translation with help from Dr. Christian Casey and Dr. Jen Thumb. Michael, thanks for sharing the story with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. There's an ongoing debate about how things got started. You know, all things. Evolution is the prevailing scientific theory, but plenty of people believe God started it all, including some people who believe wholeheartedly in evolution, like our next guest. Samuel T. Wilkinson wrote a book about the source and meaning of life called Purpose: What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Samuel T. Wilkinson is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale University, so an MD. He's also the associate director of the Yale Depression Research Program. Dr. Wilkinson's articles have been widely published and won several awards. Samuel Wilkinson, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we start with this ongoing wrestling match between religion and science, and it's one you have felt keenly in your life, as you tell us in the first words of the preface. What were you faced with early in medical school?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. The impetus to write this book essentially came from an existential crisis I had while I was a medical student. For whatever reason at this time in my life, I felt this, or I perceived this conflict and the notion that science, and in particular the theory of evolution, threatened the sense that I had, that many have, that, you know, life has purpose and value and meaning. And I kind of underwent an intense period of study and reflection. And on the other side of that period, I came away with what to me was a very satisfying sort of reconciliation. And I wrote the book because I felt that a lot of people had misperceptions about the science, what the science says, what it implies, and I believe how it can provide a framework that there's an overarching purpose and meaning to life.
Explore that a little more, though. The idea that evolution is not equal to some sort of meaning or purpose in life, is the idea that life itself is a bit of a cosmic accident, is that a bit of a daunting concept for some people?
Yeah, you know, I think this is epitomized well with a quote that I now laugh at, that I didn't laugh at the time, but there's a professor from the mid 20th century who says, you know, in the inevitable march of evolution, life is of profound unimportance, a mere eddy in the primeval slime. So, you know, part of what was really off-putting to me was this notion that our existence is an accident. And there's a lot of emerging evidence that that is not necessarily the case. And in other words, that evolution was not random.
I can see how you would have laughed at times at the primeval slime part of that thing. And yeah, it would be a little bit off-putting. So what we have here with you then is you're a man of science, but you do believe in God. And I wonder if you can explore that with us a bit. Are you thinking about the watchmaker kind, set it up and walk away, or more of an intervener kind of God?
Well, what I lay out here is essentially what might be called the God of maybe Espinoza, is a kind of a first mover. I believe in more than that personally. It's kind of hard to prove that in the same way that you can maybe prove that, a medication works for a given illness. So I kind of stay away from that part and try to stick with what the science says. And then, people can go from there. But again, going back to this point that, evolution is the randomness of evolution. I think this is one of the reasons that it has been controversial for the last century and a half, is that a lot of people assume that it implies life is just an accident. We're nothing more than tens of thousands of, intricate molecular mutations, or so the thinking has gone. And a lot of people have taken this a step further and concluded, well, there must be no inherent meaning in life. It's all just, a fluke, a lucky fluke, but a fluke nonetheless.
So is the book then intended as a guide for believers to embrace science, or perhaps a guide for trusters of science to find belief?
Well, maybe a little bit of both. I'm hoping that I primarily wrote it for people, mostly people of faith, but, even people without a specific faith, most people believe that, look, there's purpose and value and meaning in life. And I wrote it for them to kind of understand how at least the most up-to-date scientific theories of human nature and origins are not in conflict with that sense that most of us have.
Humans are divided in so many ways, though. The idea that you can get some believers thinking of science and some people in science thinking of belief, is that a hard thing at this moment in history?
It's a bit of a grandiose aspiration, I admit, but I'm hoping that I can bring some of these camps together a little bit while providing what I think is a more accurate picture of human nature than a lot of us implicitly have.
Samuel T. Wilkinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Let's come back to meaning again in our existence and talk about this in the context of your work in psychiatry and at the Yale Depression Research Program. Do depression patients often talk of wondering about the meaning of life?
Well, certainly, not necessarily the meaning of life, but certainly meaning in itself and having a sense that your life has value and purpose, that is inevitably wrapped up with our relationships with other people. It's very hard for people to find a sense of meaning in a solitary situation or circumstance.
So come back to that question again. I mean, if the creation of life on Earth was random, does that necessarily preclude us finding meaning in it?
Some people would argue no. I would. What I'm trying to frame here is provide a way that there's almost a sense of there's a not just a personal meaning, but a higher order purpose to our existence. And if you want, we can dive right into that. But
yeah, go ahead. Detail it a bit if you would. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to this issue of the randomness, right? So again, this was what was off-putting to me. There's the way this was framed by actually someone who served for a while as the dean of the Yale School of Medicine, where I now work, a man named Lewis Thomas, says, I cannot make my peace with the randomness doctrine. I cannot abide the notion of purposelessness and blind chance in nature, but I do not know what to put in its place for the quiet in my mind. Close quote. So what the evidence suggests now is that there's a lot more than just randomness. There are these high-order principles that have constrained biology to go in certain ways and not others. And the best evidence for this is the way in which creatures have developed the same structures independently. So I can give an example.
This is convergence, right?
Yes, yes, it's convergent evolution, exactly. Mostly, the scientist who more than anyone else is responsible for discovering these patterns is a man named Simon Conway Morris. He's at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And but there, going back to the what this means is that there are many instances. In fact, most things have developed independently. Most biologic traits or structures, when you think of, say, for instance, birds, bats, and butterflies, all of them have wings and the capacity for flight. But biologists tell us that through the long course of evolution, each of these creatures developed wings independently. Another example is a form of photosynthesis called C4 photosynthesis, a remarkably complex process that has developed about 60 different times independently. Another example, eyes. You know, we have these remarkable structures by which we perceive the world. All told, the estimates are that eyes have developed independently about 40 times. So you get the sense that it's not just one random thing after the other. There's a pattern here. And there's still a lot we don't know about this, but there may be, you know, some randomness to this. For instance, it may be, you know, the color of eyes you have may be the random reassortment of your parents' genes, but the fact that you have eyes structured in the way that they are seems to be almost an inevitability of the properties of biological matter.
I don't see the term used much these days, but we did talk about intelligent design for a while, and there were similar arguments to what you're talking about here. Do you fit into that intelligent design box?
Well, the underlying philosophy of intelligent design is that there are kind of holes in the evolutionary theory. There are things that don't quite add up, and that's not necessarily wrong, but they will often look for evidence of God in the gaps of our understanding, or what's sometimes called a God of the gaps. The trouble there is that in our history, science continues to fill in these gaps. So my approach to this is not looking for God in the gaps, but looking for God in the pattern and the overall framework and what it implies about things. So while I'm sympathetic to the cause of intelligent design, this is not the same kind of approach, and we would have a disagreement on the philosophical approach of this sort of discussion.
All right. Samuel Wilkinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Yale University, the author of Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Let's talk about implications from another camp. I'm not surprised to see Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist and atheist, quoted in your book several times, in fact. He and others believe what, basically, about evolution and what it means about the basic nature of humans?
Well, Dawkins believes in evolution, and he believes it is the mechanism that is responsible for our mortal existence. And in that respect, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with him. I think as things have changed over the last 60, 70 years, I'm not sure what he would say exactly about human nature now, but in his probably his most popular book, The Selfish Gene, in the opening pages of it, this was published in the 1970s, he declares, you know, if you wish to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly towards another or towards a common good, you can expect little help from biological nature because we are born selfish. And that's another reason I think that the theory of evolution has been controversial, because of what it implies about human nature is, well, at least on the surface, not very encouraging. A few years after Darwin published his most influential book, The Origin of Species, another biologist coined this phrase, survival of the fittest. And biologists don't use that term much today, but it can be instructive. And a lot of us will kind of implicitly think, oh, you know, if evolution is actually responsible for humanity, then at our core, we're selfish. And that's a bitter pill to swallow and a depressing view of human nature. But over time, we've realized that it's a bit more complex than that. And in a somewhat paradoxical way, nature shaped us to have a deep capacity for altruism.
Things like mirror neurons and stuff like that?
Well, I'm referring more at evolutionary mechanisms. So mm-hmm. Let me just give an example to illustrate this a little bit. There's a remarkable story of two shipwrecks at the same time and place in the 1860s. two ships crashed on the opposite ends of an archipelago called the Auckland Islands. It's located about 300 miles south of mainland New Zealand. Now, the crew from the ships never learned of each other's existence. The islands were vast enough that they never ran into each other. The first vessel, following about 18 months being trapped on this island, all of them, fortunately, were able to survive. The second ship, unfortunately, most of the men from that second ship died. And, you know, what was the key difference? Well, the survivors of the first ship formed a remarkably cohesive group. And this was exemplified in the first few minutes even of the shipwreck when the captain carried an injured man on his back as he swam through the waves to the safety of the shore. The crew from the second ship, on the other hand, they kind of formed this every man for himself approach. And within the first few days following their shipwreck, they left a wounded man behind to die. So you can kind of see how, you know, it's not hard to imagine scenarios in our distant past where, similar to this example of the shipwrecks, it was altruism and not selfishness that led to, you know, survival. I think this is phrased well by two eminent biologists who said that, you know, selfishness beats altruism within groups, but altruistic groups beat selfish groups, and everything else is commentary. So you can see how, well, yeah, you know, on the one hand, there were probably scenarios that favored selfishness, but on the other hand, survival can be a, you know, a kind of collective goal, and working together can enhance your chances. So in this kind of interesting way, evolution has built within us opposing capacities, and it's not just selfishness and altruism, but a host of other kind of traits that are in opposition: aggression and cooperation, cruelty, kindness. You know, it doesn't take long to think back in the, you know, the history book of humanity that, yeah, you know, human nature is this mix of deep capacities for selfishness, but also altruism. So this is what I call the dual potential of human nature.
We will explore this further when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. Samuel T. Wilkinson is our guest, the author of Purpose: What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We are talking rather deeply about things like evolution and God and how these things might work together, because they do. In our guest's perception, Samuel T. Wilkinson is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Yale University, Associate Director of the Yale Depression Research Program, and the author of a recent book called Purpose: What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. So here again, you believe in evolution, you believe God was there to start it. Do you think, Dr. Wilkinson, we can be moral and make good decisions, or at least decisions that benefit each other and humanity, without God, or at least without religion?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly there are a lot of colleagues and friends that I have who have no professed belief in God and are very good people. I think, you know, regardless of creed or religion or race or sex, all of us have a capacity to behave in ways that are helpful for others and ways that are altruistic, but all of us at the same time have a darker propensity to our nature and the capacity to act in ways that are selfish.
And when it comes to things like belief in a higher power, is the point not that we believe in a higher power, but that one believes in us?
Certainly that's part of it. I think, you know, there's been a lack of or a profound decrease in trust in humanity and others. The political polarization in the United States and the kind of the growing tension internationally among previously allied countries is evidence that our collective trust and faith in humanity has decreased. I think both can be helpful. There are certain situations that we can put ourselves in that that can help us, I think, to choose the better angels of our nature, to quote Abraham Lincoln.
Well, and in terms of choosing, though, and this is where, I mean, you do not hesitate to open up several cans of worms in the book, and one of them is free will. So
yes.
Where do you come down in thinking that we have free will or don't?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that at least the way that I think about free will is a real phenomenon. It's still a mystery to me as to where that came from in evolution, or where it comes from in the development from infancy to adulthood. But there is evidence to show that behavior is not predictable, is not highly determined, even in relatively simple organisms. That's kind of the free part. And there's lots of evidence to show that there is what we might call top-down causation. In other words, that our mental thoughts, our thinking and thought processes influence our behavior. So this is a debate that a lot of people have been having for a long time. I throw my hat into the ring and you know, provide the evidence that I feel justifies the belief that we have free will. By the way, Even if really intelligent people debate this, all of us go around virtually all the time considering ourselves free and responsible entities. And even those who, from philosophy and neuroscience and so forth, that deny free will, they don't go around thinking that. They only think that when they're engaged in these deep, you know, philosophical debates. So, you know, for those who get hung up on that point, you know, there's a chapter that I lay out the evidence to suggest that this is a rational, coherent notion that we have free will. But for most people, I don't think that's going to be a big stumbling block. Virtually everyone has this sense, this experiential notion that we have some ability to choose our actions and therefore be responsible for them.
So to the title of the book, Purpose, I mean, can you define a purpose to life?
Well, I try. And going back to what we discussed a little earlier, is it's very apparent to me, at least, that the way that nature has shaped us has left us conflicted, right? What I call the dual potential of human nature. We have immense capacity for altruism, but also, unfortunately, selfishness. And in theological terms, you might call that good and evil. And when you combine that with the observation, the empirical observation that we have free will, it provides, from my viewpoint at least, a framework that there is a universal purpose, which is to choose between, you know, the good and the evil impulses within us. Life, it seems, is a test. And it can't be a real test unless we are pulled in one direction or the other.
Well, the act of choosing itself, I mean, there are so many examples through human history of acts both wonderful and horrible, and certainly still
correct,
daily demonstrations. Does it make people nervous, do you think, to think of their own range of choices and possibilities?
Well, there's some data suggesting that, you know, when you think of yourself in an agential way, what I mean by that is as an agent that can make choices, that can lead to better mental health and better behavior. So I think when we feel like we're trapped and we can't do things, that can be harmful for mental health. And in a way, some people can take that as a bit of an excuse to misbehave when people aren't looking.
All right, so let's get into some of the ways in which evolution indicates perhaps a direction pushing us towards some sort of cooperation. And you get into things like kin selection and group selection. Can you kind of give us a rough sketch of that?
Yeah, it goes back to this example I shared of the shipwreck where, you know, the survival of the group was superior when the group was cohesive and interacting in a cooperative way. Whereas if a group is full of people who are just looking out for themselves, you know, it's going to fall apart and people left to fend for themselves in a nature ridden tooth and claw are going to have a harder time. And from an academic standpoint, just to put in a caveat here, this notion of group selection is a little bit controversial, but kin selection is not. And kin selection is essentially where, you know, the people sharing the same genes, which we know as family members, look out for one another and behave in cooperative ways. And we experience this probably more than any other creature based on the fact that our offspring are so immature when they are born. Some scholars who study infant development refer to the first 3 to 6 months of life as the, quote, fourth trimester, because in essence, our children are born half-baked. They need our help for a long, long time to become mature and responsible and be able to live independently.
Samuel Wilkinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Sorry, cut you off on a so.
So what that means, and this, you know, is a really interesting concept, that because our children are born so helpless, of necessity, we have had to develop a deep sense of love and concern for them. And, you know, this brings together these two principles of love and sacrifice, in essence, that, you know, when you ask a parent, what is the most challenging thing you've done, they'll say 9 times out of 10, well, it's raise my children. And if you ask them what is the most rewarding thing, they'll say 9 times out of 10, well, raise my children. And those kind of are inevitably, inextricably linked, right? You couldn't necessarily have one without the other. Let me try to drive this point home with just this thought experiment. Imagine how our social lives would be different if we were, say, seahorses. Now, seahorses have male pregnancy, and that would probably lead to some very different parental leave policies. But in addition to that, they have about 2,000 babies. They can birth to 2,000 babies at once. But once their offspring are born, they essentially have no more parental investment in them. And, you know, no one exactly knows what it's like to be a seahorse, but it's a good bet that they don't really have a deep love or concern for their children, because they just kind of say, okay, good luck, you know, I hope you make it and pass on my genes. Whereas if you flip this back into humans, you know, we have had to have developed this deep love and concern and altruism toward our offspring. And some people may think that's a little bit cynical, right? I only love my children because I have my genes. And I would frame it and say, well, that's how nature created you. That's how you were created.
So in terms of feeling like we're doing good things in our lives, it sounds like you're saying families, and then I don't know if there's necessarily have to be biological families or the families we create amongst groups of friends. This would seem to be the cornerstone for making humanity more human.
I think that's right. When you ask people what makes life meaningful, they mostly point to personal relationships more than work. More than status, although we seem to have a part of us that craves status or money and so forth, but those things often don't have the same enduring satisfaction that relationships bring. And certainly the relationships among family members are really critical. One of the key findings from sociological literature is that when we link men to their children, to the rearing of their children, they behave in better ways. And I think there's a strong kind of evolutionary explanation for why that is. It's because the strongest forms of altruism have developed with respect to the ways that nature has shaped family relationships.
You say in the book, no other species matches us humans and the cruelty we sometimes show to each other. And I wonder if aggression or abuse or cruelty have a, I don't know, contagious element or something. And in what context would you place times of increasingly aggressive human behaviors? And is this one of them?
Well, I think yes. And there are a lot of factors that contribute to that. One is the let's just take the internet, for instance. The anonymity that exists in the internet can fuel the mistreatment of each other when we see ourselves not necessarily as humans, but as objects. Now, this has to do with, you know, the fact that you can create usernames that have no real linkage to your identity. And this is kind of the same principle that happens with road rage. So, you know, road rage is a phenomenon, but pedestrian rage isn't really. And why is road rage a thing? It's because subconsciously, if we forget that inside that large metal box on wheels, there's actually a human being. It's not that we, of course, consciously forget it, but our subconsciousness, you know, forgets that that's a human being. And so the when we interact in ways that are completely anonymous, there's some context in which the anonymity can be helpful. There are often aspects in which it is harmful. And we will say things over the internet and so forth that we would never say to a person's face.
So do you have some ideas as we close here? You've got about a minute and a half left for how we can right the human ship, get past what appears to be an outbreak of I'm not taking your crap anymore without getting to world war, something like that.
Well, I think one of the ways we can do that is to have a deeper understanding of human nature. A lot of times in this politicized world, we're tempted to view the world as comprised of people who are fully good or fully evil. And this is wrong, and it can lead to dangerous ideologies. The world is full of people, all of whom have both strengths and weaknesses. Each one of us is a complicated mix of good and bad. And my experience as a psychiatrist, as well as a pastor, have convinced me that most people are trying to do what is right, but it's a struggle. Sooner or later, for all of us, the pull of selfishness is strong. And so, contrary to what we might infer from the culture, is that, you know, the point of life is not to point out weaknesses of your spouse, your neighbor, or even your political opponent, but the point of life is to point out and overcome our own weaknesses. But it's hard work, and we ought to be patient with ourselves and with each other.
We started out talking about your entry into medical school and the existential crisis that gave you. How long have you worked on this book?
Well, I've wanted to write it for almost 15 years. I had to put it on the shelf for about 10 or 12 years while I finished my medical training and picked it back up right as COVID started. And it's been a challenge, but it's been immensely rewarding.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. Samuel T. Wilkinson is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Yale University, the associate director of the Yale Depression Research Program, as you heard, a pastor as well. His book is Purpose, What Evolution and Human Nature Imply About the Meaning of Our Existence. Dr. Wilkinson, thank you so much for sharing this on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And it's been a pleasure having you listen to The Exchange today. That'll do it for today's program. Check us out at jeffexchange.org. All of our interviews end up archived there, and they're also sent out to your favorite podcasting sites like Apple and Spotify. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. Charlie Zimmerman from Southern Oregon University is our assistant producer. Zach Beagle is our other student engineer. Maxwell and Terry Longshore composed our theme music. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Join us next time and have a great day.